million-selling author Len Deighton. It holds up remarkably well, both the book and the film, The Ipcress File. Does that give you a source of some particular satisfaction?
Yes, it does, really. Yes. Of course, I've never gone back and read any of the books after I've written them, but I think the fact it's still on sale after so long is quite a lucky break for me. I think that Sidney Furey, who directed the film, and I think Michael and the book itself just came together, and they were all perfect. And I think the fact that the film was made on a low budget was very, very good for it. It kept it looking very gritty in a way that, had it had more money spent on it and become glossy and rather James Bond, I think would have lost the essence of what makes it a good film.
You mentioned the three of you coming together, the director, the actor, Michael Caine, and
yes.
You, and that being a perfect coincidence of talent.
Yes.
Are you talking about perfect for the time, matching the mood of the time, the early 60s, middle 60s?
Well, I suppose it did. I mean, I think the thing we all had in common is that we were all very cheap. it wasn't that anyone went through trying to select the greatest talents, that Michael was freely available and Sidney Furey was freely available and I was freely available, that it was just a coincidence that we came together. I think probably the 60s were a very optimistic time when everyone felt things were going to change. We know now that they didn't change very much, and all those changes that took place have all been rectified and it's all gone back to square one again. But it was optimistic, and I think the film had that kind of rather sly but cheerful element that makes it last. It could easily have become it's like a very sour joke, but as you say, considering how old the film is, I think it's extraordinarily good.
In 1962, when the book, The Ipcress File, came out, it was called the Book of the Year by both the Sunday Times and The Observer, and someone whom one would expect to be a rival, Ian Fleming, called it his favourite book.
Yes, well, it was very kind. I mean, I think probably nowadays, of course, that couldn't happen, that books of everything has become much more pretentious, I think, in the world generally, in sort of middle-class life has become very pretentious, cooking has become very pretentious, people's reading habits have become, well, perhaps they haven't become pretentious, but people have become pretentious in describing what they would like other people to think their habits are. But in those days, people, I think, were perfectly willing to have a thriller as a book of the year. I don't think there have been many thrillers as books of the year over recent years.
Well, that leads me very neatly, and I don't think you're aware I'm going to do this to you, that in the Times, just a matter of 2 or 3 weeks ago, excuse me, there was a review of your newest book, Berlin Game, which began as follows, and if you remember, in the middle of October, we were all talking about the Booker Prize for literature. So, Deighton hasn't been shortlisted for the Booker. I haven't yet read the novels that were, but they need to be pretty damn good to equal the writing here. Do you ever feel resentful that you're not considered to be literature and you don't win things like the Booker Prize?
No. In fact, I would like my publisher to put across the front of the book that the publisher and author guarantee that this book has no literary merit whatsoever. I've got no ambition in that direction. I think it's quite complicated enough, as far as I'm concerned, to write mainstream popular fiction without adding a dimension of art.
Now that's a curious distinction you've made there, as if art can't be entertaining and entertainment can't be art. Do you really believe that?
I think art, if it's worthwhile, is probably quite demanding. I suppose there's some sorts of art, perhaps if we included architecture, which have an immediate appeal and an immediate acceptance. But I think the great majority of art it requires work from the consumer. A lot of work from his consumer, and perhaps even sort of an education from his consumer. I mean, painters have different attitudes to painting than people who are not painters. Since most art critics are not painters and have never been painters, never been trained as painters, usually art critics differ in their attitude to painting, to the sort of views that are expressed by painters.
As a young
man, do you see what I mean?
Yes, as a young man, you were interested in art.
Yes, I studied art until I was sort of in my early 30s. I never thought of earning a living any other way. I mean, it never crossed my mind that there was any other way of earning a living.
So what happened to the art?
Well, England is a country where artists are regarded rather like milkmen and plumbers and so on. They have a very, very low status. I don't mind having a low status, but it does. I worked in an advertising agency, for instance, and it was my feeling that the creative side of advertising is the in visual terms and is the most important ingredient. But in England, the decisions are always made by people who have no technical background. You know, we're a nation who rather despises people who have a technical education. And the more what people, the big decisions in Britain are made by people who have a general education, and usually by people who don't understand the technical consequences of the decisions they make. I think that accounts for a lot of the trouble we get into, both industrially, commercially, and politically.
That's a very heavy statement. What do you think about our education system, if it creates all those kind of problems?
Well, I mean, I've really have quite a lot of doubts about the idea of handing, by law, handing over your children to the government for education. I think it's probably not exploited, but it is a totalitarian concept, isn't it? I think really the Western world's been very lucky to have escaped so lightly, given the fact that the government monopoly of it, or virtual monopoly of education, is so widely accepted.
I think I must pursue that for a moment.
Sure.
Are you saying that it would be better if kids didn't have to go to school, that we as parents chose whether or not to send our children to the local school?
I would hesitate to take it as sweepingly as that, but I would certainly say that parents should be able to choose where their school goes. I certainly think the schools should be allowed to decide which children they want in and which children they don't want in. I think the worst thing that we have now is that we have bureaucrats choosing school books. And because school books are chosen by bureaucrats, and they are a very expensive ingredient of the whole education plan, then the exams and everything we educate our children to is likely to be stymied and built around the existing contracts for school books. Mm. I think there's not nearly enough flexibility. I would like to see some schools good at some things and bad at other things, rather like universities are. And children and parents and teachers given much more flexibility in what they want to teach, how they want to teach it, what sort of examinations they do, and have varied children of varied interests and varied attainments coming out of widely different schools.
What about your own schooling, your own family, your own background? Your father was a chauffeur.
Yes. Well, I went sort of 11 plus and onto a grammar school. That was my education. I came out of the grammar school and it was conscription, so I went into the Air Force for 2.5 years. And I was very, under normal way, I was trained as a photographer, and a normal thing would have been for me to go into, I suppose, work in a dark room somewhere and just be relegated to the social scrap heap. But I was very lucky that we had, in those days, a thing that the American equivalent was called the GI Bill of Rights. It was a way in which people coming out of the service were allowed to go for further education. And so I went for 3 years to art school, and then I passed a scholarship to go to the Royal College. And again, the education authority kept paying me because I was an ex-serviceman, you see, not because I was a student, not because I'd passed an exam, or not because they thought it was a good thing to have designers or artists, but simply because I was an ex-service man.
I'm interested in the very, if you like, your early beginnings, because I detect in several of your works a resentment at privileged background. You there's, for example, an exchange in your new book in which the person from the East says, well, it must be wonderful for you in the West not to have to be a member of the party to make progress in career and socially and so on. You say, ah, but over here you have to go to Eton and Oxbridge. Now, tell me a little about your background, because in a sense you're both inside the establishment and outside the establishment.
Yes.
Insofar as your father was a chauffeur driving the Eton, Oxbridge-type persons around.
Yes. Yes, it was a very funny childhood, because I was in a big sort of upstairs-downstairs house. I mean, I grew up in a house with... I'm very fond of telling people I grew up in a house with 15 servants. just that my father was one of the servants, you see. It was good from a writer's point of view, because it gave one an insight into the multi-strata of say modern. I say modern life, of course. That sort of household has more or less vanished now. But it was an insight also in historical terms into what the earlier years of the century must have been like.
Can I take yes? How your contemporaries viewed your situation? I mean, when you were playing at school, it must have been quite something in the 30s for you to have access to a car, for example. But then perhaps there was a double twist insofar as your father was a servant.
Yes, well, my father was wearing a blue peaked cap and a white shirt and a black tie sort of thing. Yeah.
Was there a mixture of pride and, not shame exactly, but slight reluctance
well,
to admit?
Well, no. I think in those days, attitudes were very, very... different. I mean, domestic service nowadays, I think people tend to look down on it and avoid it, rather like they do. I think it's an English characteristic, not only an English characteristic, but it is a strong English characteristic. It's why, even though we have 3 million people out of work, every restaurant you go into will have Spanish waiters, won't it? There is an aversion to actually waiting on people or domestic service, that sort of thing, which didn't exist, or if it did exist, I didn't encounter it when I was a child. That there wasn't that same sort of them and us feeling. And I think in the case of, because one is influenced by one's parents and their attitude. And my father's attitude to his boss was that his boss was extremely clever. You know, he was an extremely clever man. And so my father didn't feel demeaned by working for another person, because he had such respect for him intellectually.
Did you have respect for your father?
Yes, I suppose it was a exactly similar thing, yes.
It's interesting that you're saying in those days it wasn't deemed to be demeaning.
Yes.
One of the egalitarian legacies, if you like, of the 60s is perhaps explaining why exactly the situation exists that you just described, that people are less willing to go into what would generally called service.
Yes.
What are your children... What kind of school do your children go to?
Well, at present they're in a tiny village school in France.
Well, let me put it the other way around.
Yes.
You're now a very wealthy man.
Well...
And your children have a very wealthy father, unlike you, in relation to your father. Would you buy the kind of education that you've... despise, certainly, in your books.
No, there's no need to... I would do everything I can to prevent my children being educated in England, because the moment you step across the threshold of any school in England, you've put on a uniform for the class war, haven't you?
Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, that everyone educated in England has been assigned rank badges for the class war. I mean, you are... what's it saying, My Fair Lady, every time an Englishman opens his mouth, some other Englishman despises him. And it is true, and it all stems from the educational system. I would much rather, as I say, at present my kids are at school in just an ordinary village school in France, because there's no one in this little village school who speaks English. They're having to find some way of speaking French. I don't think you... the sort of education that you pay for is not the sort of education I want or wanted or covet or feel inferior about, and it's not anything I would want my children to to have either.
On the face of it, this strong hostility to class differences and divisions that you've just described doesn't seem to sit comfortably with your strong anti-communism that features in many of your books. They would seem to be incompatible.
Well, I think communism is not an egalitarian creed, really, you see. It is highly strata-ized. And for the most part, communist regimes tend to be totalitarian tyrannies. I mean, it's just a device whereby, I mean, there's in Eastern Europe, there's this very, very old joke about capitalism is the exploitation of man by man, but communism is the exact opposite. Where it sort of sums up everything one need say.
Back to the things you write about, rather than the things you, your views on the world as it really is. Perhaps they're the same thing. Did you ever come across any real spies?
Well, yeah, I suppose it depends on what you call it. But certainly one absolutely certificated, sort of absolute copper-bottomed spy that I did come across was when I was, I think, about 11. In 1940, my father was a chauffeur, lived in a mews. You see, we sort of lived over the top of where the cars were garaged. And but some of the places in the mews had been converted into smart bijou residences, you know, sort of thing, which most of them nowadays are. And one of these was occupied by a lady called Volkov, who, his father, had, I think, been the Russian naval attaché in London at the time of the Russian Revolution. And she was a right-wing extremist, and she was working with a cipher clerk from the American embassy, and they were putting material back to Rome through the diplomatic pouch. She was collecting, she would have quite well-known people, including, I believe, cabinet ministers, came to her house for dinner parties, and she would make notes of the talk. It was more material of a climate of opinion. A lot of sort of espionage is interested in this, what the climate of opinion
is. How old are you when this started?
I suppose 11, 10 or 11, I suppose.
And was she caught? Was she in prison?
Oh, yes. I mean, I used to see her a lot, because my mother would go in and cook. When she had a dinner party, she would ask my mother to go and cook for her, see, in the house next door. And so I saw this woman quite a lot. I mean, she was, you know, I see her almost every day. And then one morning, the special branch they were sort of banging at the door and everything, and they took her away, and I think she got 14 years. Oh. She was at the Old Bailey, and it was one of the big spy trials of the Second World War.
Was this the genesis of Harry Palmer?
Well, I don't know. I had forgotten it for a little while. Then it sort of came back into, after I'd been writing spy books for some years, I've remembered it. It came back into my mind. And so I think it probably, you know, it's very formative age for a child. I think probably did have an effect on me, I think, yes.
Now, the bulk of your fiction has been about a very real contemporary problems of the Cold War, by and large.
Yes, yes.
Now, the latest phase in the Cold War, of course, is the arrival of cruise missiles. Would you use that as the core of a plot now, if you're starting on a book tomorrow?
Oh, it's very good. I mean, it's very good stuff, certainly. I mean, I think that it is one of the biggest problems for the Western defence and for NATO and so on, the demonstrations against cruise missiles. I think it's a very good theme. Certainly, one. I mean, if the situation was reversed, I mean, if one could imagine cruise missiles being installed in Russia, and the sort of potential for encouraging protests about it that we have in the West, you can see that the KGB obviously are taking a great interest in this. I would say it's probably their prime thing. In fact, NATO issued a public statement saying that they estimated that 80% of the signals traffic from embassies in the West, KGB signal traffic, was devoted to the peace movement and protest movement in one way or another. It's a vast amount of
interest. You've done a lot of factual research to back up both your fiction and, excuse me, to give substance to your actual histories of, for example, Fighter, the Battle of Britain. How would you, if I'm taking a liberty here, then do please say so, but because you are meticulous in your research, because you have received acclamation as a historian of recent battles and so on, how do you perceive the state of the Cold War now?
Well, I think that the Pope once, many years ago, said that what we have to fear most is not a godless world, but a faithless church. And I think that all the manifestations we are seeing seem to be with communism in the ascendant. But I think there is a tremendous erosion going on, as a moral erosion going on in the East. I'll give you an example of that. That 10 years ago, in the countries that I've visited in the East, people just didn't take tips. They would, if you gave them a tip, they would say, no, the sort of society that we have here, is not based upon that sort of subservience, that tip. Now, the last time I was in East Germany, I had incessant, so room waiters would deliver your breakfast, and they would try to con me into believing that I had to pay cash in Western money for the breakfast, despite the fact it would go on that the breakfast was really going on the bill. I mean, it's quite an unscrupulous wanting of Western currency, for instance. And I think that this is a tremendous increase in corruption in the East. That people who want housing and so on very often find that they get the things they want by bribing officials. It's not a secret that this is something everyone in the East is very, very well aware of. And just if we have our worries about the sort of decline of moral standards in the West, they are different. But their moral standards are having an effect upon their political theory. Our moral standards are having an effect upon crime, and they're having an effect upon education, they're having an effect on other things, but they're not really changing our political attitudes.
Well, does that mean the risk of war, hot war coming from the Cold War, is greater or lesser in your judgment?
I think that it is true that the military in the West are discredited, really. I mean, in the West, in America and in Europe, the soldier occupies a low position in sort of prestige ranks. This is not true in the East. In the East, both in financial terms and in personal prestige, the military are very, very important. This is a dangerous element.
We're almost run out of time, but there's something I must ask you. I noticed on page 102 of the Berlin Game that you say that when President Kennedy was in Berlin and declared his loyalty or affinity with that city, he actually made a big blunder. Could you tell me very briefly about that?
Well, he said, "Ich bin ein Berliner," and a Berliner is a form of donut when the word is normally used. So the morning after he'd made the speech that all the newspapers had little talking donuts.
It was a sort of Berlin joke. How should he have said it?
I don't know. I think he should have found some other way of expressing that idea.
It's that New England accent. It confuses so many people. Len Dayton, thanks for coming in. Thanks for speaking on such a broad range of subjects and not being scared to make the odd political judgment as well.